Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, protests continue around the country, including Charlotte, following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Mostly peaceful. Some protests get dicey. Police reactions, again, mostly calm, occasionally become overly aggressive, and that is also the case here. The Republican National Convention changes its plans and changes its plans again and continues to change its plan. Part of the convention may or may not be here. The main event will move elsewhere, most likely. We look at the impact of that. And coronavirus cases continue to rise. We experience 7 consecutive triple-digit increases in as many days, though hospitalizations have dropped. And in the middle of all this, the county passes a budget. Here to update us on all that and more is Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome back. Good to see you. Mary Seacole, well, you got to respond. Come on.
Good to see you, Mike. Good morning.
Thank you. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist
for Roll
Call.
Good morning. Good to see you, Mike. Mm-hmm.
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and contributor to WCCB-TV News. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Can I get some sleep soon?
Sure. Glenn Berkins is founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. He looks like he is asleep this morning. Good morning. Welcome back. And Andos Helms
morning,
is
Mike.
Here. Good morning. Andos Helms is here from WFAE News. Morning to you.
Good morning.
So, in cities and towns, large and small, coast to coast, and here in Charlotte this week, was marked by protests over the death at the hands of police in Minneapolis of George Floyd.
George Floyd! George Floyd! George Floyd! Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
The sound of peaceful protests here in Charlotte that took place during the day. At night, the unrest became more tense.
Hey, hey! You must leave the immediate vicinity. If you remain in the immediate vicinity, you will be in violation of the law.
It is clear that the death of George Floyd has struck a nerve and released a flood of pent-up emotion, given the numbers of people around the world who have been marching in protest and the fact that these demonstrations have gone on day after day. I think today will mark the 11th day of protests. What is happening here? Something is different.
It's because it's about George Floyd, but it's about more than that. You see that in all of these cities that are having the protests, each city has that name that you can put to it. Like we have the Jonathan Farrell, the Keith Lamont Scott, and Louisville has the Breonna Taylor. And it's the relationship between law enforcement and communities of color, particularly African Americans. And it's something that's been going on for generations.
Yes, but why now? What has opened the floodgate about this incident now, after all of these incidents, one after the other after the other?
Well, I think one of the things that's going on.
People have been saying it. African Americans have been talking about it, and so often other white folks who are policed differently have said, you know, there must have been something, or they've been taking the word of law enforcement. And now you can see that almost nine minutes with the officer's knee on the neck was so stark and brutal that you see now with the protests, it's white, black, all ages, because you know, finally people are saying, are the police going to be our protectors and guardians? And it's also with COVID and the economic upheaval. So we're looking at systems. You know, COVID is disproportionately affecting Black and Brown Americans. They're disproportionately hit economically. So people are more willing to say it's a systemic problem. It's not just one bad police officer. It's systemic, and something has to change.
Eric.
Yeah, I agree with what Mary's saying. I mean, I think that you can't overlook or sort of undersell the combination of this tragedy occurring at the same time as we have this pandemic. Because the pandemic, as so many people have said, has really just accelerated and shown how much societal imbalance we have, how much economic inequity we have. And I think when you see that play out against the backdrop of this horrifying video, 9 minutes of a human being's life being lost, that the power of that is obviously tremendous. And the thing that stands out to me is, while we have had pockets of these kinds of protests, in the last 5-10 years, this one is everywhere. I mean, it's blanketing the country. It's blanketing the world, as I think at least a couple of our panelists will share with us soon. So it's just incredible, the outpouring of emotion that has come with this.
The other thing that I would point out is that the African-American community, to a large extent, never fully recovered from the Great Recession. Black Americans lost their homes to foreclosure in far disproportionate numbers because they were victims of predatory lending. They lost their jobs. We saw after witnessing the wealth gap between Black and white Americans begin to narrow, we saw a chasm open up again. So George Floyd was the match that lit the fire, if you will, but it's so much more. I would argue that so far this has been probably the most significant civil unrest we've seen since the 70s. Certainly, in terms of its duration and its intensity. And one of the other things that I will point out is here in Charlotte, at least. This is the most diverse group of protesters that I've seen. I was around for some of the others, and I've never seen a protest with this degree of racial diversity.
Yeah.
I think what Mary said is exactly right about these last few years have sort of been a crash course for white America in systemic racism. I think a few years ago, I would have been saying, and maybe a lot of us would have been saying, well, what does this horrible cop in Minneapolis have to do with Charlotte? And we have just seen it play out. And like Glenn said, we are seeing crowds that are certainly significantly Black, but also white people. You know, I watched the march through Myers Park, and there were plenty of Myers Park residents standing out with signs of support and handing out water. So I think people are no longer saying, oh, why are they so upset about this? People are saying, this is us. This is something we have to deal with.
And I don't think you can underestimate the sheer pain and anguish that are getting people out to the street. In a way, you want to say you're glad there's video because it's evidence, but also particularly a lot of African Americans I know are saying, we don't want, it's Black pain. It's almost pornography, Black death. And people are traumatized. And so you see just the anger, they have to get out and say this.
And I would be remiss if I did not point out what General Mattis said just a couple days ago or yesterday. We have no leadership in Washington. For the first time, he said, for the first time in his lifetime, we have a president that is not seeking to unite the country. And it's been that way for 3 years.
Right.
And these things tend to happen when there is no leadership at the top.
I want to stress that for the most part, the protesters and for the most part, the police have been peaceful. But there have been these incidences of overreaction across the country. It happened in Washington, D.C., in front of the White House, as federal law enforcement used tear gas, even their shields as weapons to clear the area, including going after journalists who were clearly journalists because they were holding cameras and microphones so that the president could cross the street for a photo op. But it also happened here in Charlotte on Tuesday night. Queen City Nerve's Justin LaFrancois was streaming that night's protest as demonstrators were walking, I think north on 4th Street, crossing the intersection with College. Justin was at the back of the protest when all hell broke loose. This is a long piece of audio, but it is in real time, and he's talking about the police at the very beginning of this clip.
So what they're going to do So you're going to let this whole group go through. Then they're going to swing through and they're going to hold this line. And they're going to march behind us and push us up the street fast. They're not going to let us walk at our own pace. And they're going to shoot pepper balls if we stop. And people will run. It's already happening. You can see. They've got everybody trapped here. We're trapped, there's tear gas. We're trapped here. We're trapped. They're shooting pepper balls at us. They've thrown out tear gas, flashbangs, smoke. They just chased everybody down this way. There's a line of riot police up there. There's a line of riot police back there. We're trapped. We're trapped here. They're up top shooting at us.
That was on Tuesday night here in Charlotte. Justin LaFrancois from Charlotte's Queen City Nerve was at the back of the protesters. Melody Rogers recorded what it sounded like at the front.
Okay.
So, is that the only incidence of this kind of activity in Charlotte where they were corralled into an area and evidently assaulted from the ground and from on top of buildings and or parking decks with rubber and pepper bullets? Anybody know?
Well, we certainly know there's been a lot of tear gas. There's been a lot of flashbangs, rubber bullets, things like that.
And these were peaceful protesters. These people were not breaking windows. They were not looting. They were not setting fires. They were simply marching.
I think certainly all the city officials have said this was not what should have happened. Now, Chief Kerr Putney keeps saying, I want to release video. I want you to see how it looked from the other side. But yeah, it was unusual.
Here's Vi Lyle's response.
Last night was one of those times that none of us can be proud of, that we wouldn't want to see happen in our city. But it did, and I hope everyone is aware that that's not the kind of department we want to have for policing. It's not the kind of reputation that we want to have nationally or locally. So when you look at that, we have to understand that we can be better than that.
And as she was speaking, CMPD released a statement, and I'll read part of that statement when we come back. We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, contributor to WCCB TV. We just played Mayor Lyles reacting to the violence on Tuesday night perpetrated by the police on peaceful protesters here in Charlotte. As she was speaking in that clip that we just played, CMPD released a statement that over a four-hour period on that Tuesday evening, 16 protesters were arrested, and there were at least 18 incidents of objects thrown at officers. They reported 9 dispersal orders were given and 3 guns were recovered, including an assault rifle. And they said, quote, there is nothing to indicate whatsoever that there was intentional abuse on the part of our officers. Then what does this indicate? And have they reversed that position in the days that followed? Glenn.
I think what this really shows, Mike, and I think we have to be clear-eyed. Whenever a law enforcement uses force, it is never a pretty thing, whether they are simply making an arrest when someone is attempting to resist or they're attempting to control a crowd. It is not a pretty thing to look at. So we have to ask ourselves in a situation like that when there has been an order to disperse, what comes next? They can. So I think we have to be honest, even as we evaluate the use of things like pepper balls, the use of things like flashbangs on civilians. If you've ever followed policing, it is often not a nice thing to watch, and I think that part of it is getting lost in this conversation.
Yeah, we had the incidents, I think it was in Boston last night, of a police group coming down a street, and there was a 75-year-old white guy standing there trying to talk to them, and they literally pushed him over, and he got a gash in his head, and one officer did not allow another officer to help him. In Buffalo, did not allow him to help the fellow on the ground. He turns out to be okay, but nonetheless, it was a disturbing thing to see. This incident in Charlotte has gotten us national attention, not the kind of attention we want. And also the whole situation in America has gotten us international attention. Both Mary and Glenn, you were called on by news organizations in other parts of the world. What do they want to know? What are they curious about? Mary.
First of all, President Trump has backed the country off of a lot of international alliances. So he has taken away that area where he's saying, I'm the head of the world, you know? And so they really want to know, first of all, about this issue of systemic racism. And they call on me because I'm a journalist and also because I'm an African-American woman who grew up in a city, Baltimore, that has its Freddie Gray and others. And I had the life experience. And they want to talk about America's role, because some of the countries, of course, have their own situations. So it's up to them to say, you know, we're not so bad. Look at America. But it's true that America holds itself up as the shining beacon. So they want to know about that. And they want to know about our political, because I'm a political columnist, they want to know about what our political leadership is doing about it, what will be the next steps, and if it will affect the elections going forward, because all the world's eyes are on the United States right now.
And you spoke to somebody in Ireland, is that right, Glenn?
That's correct. I spoke with reporters in Ireland who were very much interested in police tactics. They wanted to know, they were hearing about flashbangs. They wanted to know what those were. Fascinated that officers here use chemicals to disperse crowds. They pointed out that in Ireland, police officers don't even carry guns. Like Mary, they wanted to know about the systemic racism and how this might affect the upcoming elections. But they were really incredulous, you know, when it came to policing tactics here versus how things are handled there.
I do think that military equipment that we have see in our city streets, when when people show up with riot gear and you can't see their faces and truncheons and flashbangs and batons and the protesters don't have anything, you see it in some cities where the police have approached them without any gear, and immediately that lowers the temperature. But now we have the Obama administration had pulled back from the program where local police departments got excess heavy military gear, but the Trump administration let that loose again. So we do see this incredible force. And when people have that force and somehow a bottle comes from the crowd, we've seen them train it maybe on the whole crowd, and then everything escalates.
So protesters here have insisted that there was no dispersal warning on 4th Street on Tuesday night before the tear gas was unleashed. This has led to the State Bureau of Investigation being charged with investigating this incident, and the mayor has asked for police body camera footage to be released. CMPD Chief Kerr Putney echoed that and said, "There are a lot of other angles and videos and perspectives that you need to see. I didn't like what I saw, and I can't wait until I can share more.
I just don't like the way it looks. I wish it told the full story. I just don't like how it looks. And it flies in the face of where we are morally as an organization, because our goal is to allow for lawful protests. However, what is missed sometimes is when violence occurs and property damage occurs, it's no longer a lawful protest, it's a riot. So it's all troubling to me. But most importantly, I don't like how it looks, and I don't like the fact that it's going to take time before the full story can get out and tell truly what happened, and then there can be the appropriate accountability."
Why is it going to take time? I mean, it's a state law that only judges can release body camera footage from the police, which is counterproductive to a free society. Has the judge been asked for a ruling? How long might that take? And why do things take so long when they have really pushed things along in other areas of this country?
Well, the chief has said he's going to go to court and ask to release the body cam video. And, you know, we talked a lot in the previous shows. It seems counterproductive, but we've seen more videos since they've had this because various people have gone to judges who have said, yes, you have to release it. So I think the other delay on the police department's end is that they have asked for an internal investigation. And any entity is very reluctant to start releasing information piecemeal while an investigation is going on. There are people who are very skeptical about the State Bureau of Investigation doing an investigation that is not in favor of the police.
And it's interesting, Mike, to hear Chief Putney. You know, you heard that clip where he says there are other angles. He wants people to see the whole picture. At the same time, he says it's very disturbing what you see on the video. And then when the council and the mayor had that, public meeting or forum in front of the government center, the chief did come out and he answered someone's question about whether they would use tear gas again by saying, well, if there's no violence, we won't use tear gas. And that's all happening at the same time. You have Congresswoman Alma Adams, you have Braxton Winston from City Council, you have State Representative Chaz Beasley, among others, saying absolutely not. There should be no chemical agents used by Charlotte police ever. So,
well, let's talk about that.
Long drawn out debate.
And let's talk about this because I did not know this until this week that the Geneva Convention makes the use of tear gas and other chemical agents illegal by military forces in times of war and in war zone. And yet in the United States, police departments can use this material on American citizens. Congresswoman Alma Adams has said weapons that are illegal in war should never be used on American soil, especially against our own people. It's been happening nationwide. This is not the first time these agents have been used. Are other leaders around the country sharing similar sentiments?
Oh, definitely.
I think you're hearing a lot of this.
And we've seen other elected officials who've been marching with the protesters in peaceful protests who themselves have been gassed or hit with pepper spray. And so, of course, yes, they're speaking up. And the stakes are raised because we see the president threatening to send U.S. military to the streets, which would mean they would have these weapons to use on American soil, which is why you now see a lot of the military folks themselves pushing back.
So I know that on I think Monday night, and we've talked about this on this program this week with Braxton Winston, the at-large city council member who was arrested at the very first night of protests last Friday night. Braxton Winston is saying he will propose Monday night to end funding of chemical agents for CMPD to use in crowd control. He also wants to create a city council and manager oversight committee to evaluate, scrutinize, and recommend adjustments to police spending and policy involving such tactics. What options should be available to police? Although we haven't had the kind of violence and destruction and fires and looting that they have experienced in places like Minneapolis and other major cities, the potential is there for that. And certainly during the last demonstrations, we had some of that damage going on, and we had damage in this instance. What tools should be available? Can you afford to neuter the police?
That's a very good question, Mike, and I don't have the answer to that. I can say that I've covered conflicts around the world. I've seen chemicals released in various settings in countries all around the world, and I've yet to see chemicals end a protest. I've seen them scatter protesters. I've seen them create chaos among protesters. But I've never seen the release of chemicals actually do what the authorities were hoping they would do, I guess, is you know, send everyone home or cause everyone to leave the street. So, I think it's a valid question. What should be in the arsenal of law enforcement officers in the United States? And I think that's a conversation that's long overdue, not just here in Charlotte, but nationally.
By the way, this discussion of, go ahead, Mike.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, this discussion of militarized police, which has been going on for some time now and is now back in the spotlight. It's interesting in Charlotte, not only with Tuesday's incident, but remember, this is a city that just accepted a $50 million federal security grant for the Republican National Convention. And with that typically comes a lot of equipment that, in the eyes of some, is further militarizing of police forces.
And also that money, we got that money when the Democratic National Convention was here, and we bought a lot of equipment with it, and our police were trained for potential problems at that convention, of which none materialized. And I'm sure the same thing has been happening in advance of the Republican convention. And until this week, it was a fait accompli. It was coming here. And so that we got $50 million for equipment and training. And I know that CMPD has been going through sensitivity training. Is this the result of all of that? What we're witnessing? This is it?
Well, and it, Mike, we have spent so much time in the past, I don't know, two, three, four, however many years on this show and others talking about de-escalation, about changes in policy and training at CMPD. And these are issues that are going on all over the country. But clearly, we're still in the same debate and we're still having the same contentious issues again and again.
What about
also,
leaders?
You have to realize that these protests are protesting police brutality. So they're protesting the people who are policing the protests. And you have to think police are human. And they realize that they're the ones that people are protesting against.
But the interesting thing about this is these protests against police brutality are the result of camera video of police brutality. And as these protests go on, and there are instances of police brutality, people protesting police brutality are getting police brutality in exchange, and it too is being caught on camera. What are these people thinking? And I'm talking about law enforcement.
Well, it speaks to the culture of law enforcement. So that's why, I mean, I'm not proposing this, but some people who say you've got to just abolish it and start from scratch, yeah, it's because they feel it's in the culture.
And you think about when you hear the president say, go in there, be strong, dominate, that there are people who are repulsed by that, and there are people who are inspired by that.
Sure.
And some of the people who are inspired may be on police forces, Charlotte and elsewhere.
Let's talk about leadership, because there have been places in this country where mayors and police chiefs and sheriffs who have gone out into the crowd very quickly and kind of neutralized things. When a police officer or a chief or a sheriff gets down on one knee with the protesters, That kind of diffuses the situation. When mayors go out and say what has happened here is deplorable, that kind of diffuses the situation. Were Charlotte leaders late to the game? I know that Vi Lyles came out and joined the protesters, as did Tariq Bakari, as did Braxton Winston from the very beginning. But for the most part, was Charlotte late to the game? Was the police chief late to the game? Was Gary McFadden, the sheriff, late to the game? Or have they done things we just haven't reported on?
I don't know if you can make a blanket statement, Mike. I think it's a really a mixed bag. I mean, there are examples we've seen. I think it was the captain of the Uptown District. Is that the Central District, I guess? He took a knee with protesters either yesterday or the day before. We've seen instances, where officers have said, including the chief, have said they're repulsed by what happened in Minneapolis. And you also have to figure into this the changing nature, and I'm not defending one side or the other, but the changing nature of these protests each day. It starts out peaceful, and then as you get later into the night, the tenor changes. So I think there's so many dynamics, it's hard to say whether it was all good or all bad in terms of leadership.
As I mentioned,
we have to remember back to Friday, there are groups that have been very active in the community for a long time and have relationships with the police department, even if they're rocky relationships. And they were planning actions starting, I think, on Sunday. And then this Facebook group came up and said there's going to be something on Friday night. And I think a lot of us, I know Glenn, I've heard that from, a lot of us have heard that the people who are very active in this movement didn't know who was calling for this. And so there was a lot of reacting going on that Friday night.
So Braxton Winston was among the first people arrested in all of this last Friday night on Bates Ford Road. We talked to him about it earlier this week on this program. But on Monday night at the city council meeting, Braxton Winston asked the incoming chief of police, Johnny Jennings, about that whole situation.
What could I have done differently to not get arrested?
You could have left. When the dispersal order was given, you could have walked away. I'm not going to try your case here talking to you on at this meeting, but the bottom line is that the people that left, they did not get arrested. You stayed there, you remained, and you were part of the line as officers pushed through, and that's what happened. So if you want to talk further offline about that, I'll be happy to do it, but I think you're well aware of the situation.
Should police have taken a different approach with a sitting city council member? I have 10 seconds.
I would say no. I think that a city council member should get the same treatment that anyone else gets, but they should all get fair treatment.
Glenn Birkins is from Q City Metro. We're coming back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Ann Doss Helms is here from WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. And Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. I want to move on to some other topics. But before I do, the root of all of these protests, the root of the pain and the anguish that these protests are illustrative of, comes from systemic racism. And when it comes to schools, former Charlotte Mecklenburg school superintendents have attempted, Ann, to confront racism over the years. Heath Morrison, if anybody remembers him, was kind of shot down when he wanted to bring in an anti-racist consultant. Clayton Wilcox made some powerful statements on this program and elsewhere about racism within CMS. And now Ernest Winston, the latest superintendent, has made some remarks to students and staff about this latest incident of racism. What has he said?
Well, he sent out statements that in various levels of detail, and I think the most detailed one went to staff. And he talked about that there is a difference between not being a racist and being someone who fights actively against and resists racism and says, we have to do that. We must dismantle the systems that create inequitable outcomes. We have an opportunity to create an education experience that is significantly better than the dated public education system that a lot of us grew up with. So he is the second African-American superintendent. The first one, James Pusley, was really of a different generation. I think very aware of and affected by systemic racism, but you didn't talk about it. You put your head down and you got the job done. And Ernest Winston is just the most personable individual you could ever meet, but he is saying some of these things pretty bluntly, and I think people are ready to listen now.
And Anne, I think as someone who's dealt with the system as a parent, there's so many issues that are in the soil, even inherent bias with some of the teaching and who are the kids that you tag for gifted programs, things like that. It is such a, and this is getting kids at the very beginning. So there's so much work to do, and there's going to be challenges because of the online learning and trying to come out of COVID and deal with inequities that are made worse.
County Commission has expressed frustration just this week over the school system's failure to help students of color succeed. This is a running theme across the country. You heard it yesterday at George Floyd's funeral. Speakers getting up there and talking about how the American education system has failed people of color. And two African-American ministers urged commissioners this week to withhold money from CMS because so many children of color are failing. I'm just curious how withholding money would help.
I think that's a really good question, and CMS would say absolutely it would not. I mean, this is one of those situations, and we see it over and over. It is much easier to articulate a problem than to solve it, but you can't solve a problem until you've identified it and named it. So this is people just saying we need something to essentially smack everybody upside the head and make them realize we've got to do something different. We can't keep hemming and hawing and having the same results. But, you know, Vilma Leek, and you cannot doubt her sincerity, I think, when she's talking about this. She was on the school board. That board didn't solve it. I have not seen anybody come up with a solution. It's not like if we just buy this one program, we've got it fixed. But what you were just seeing was this anger and anguish that we keep talking about it and we don't seem to be getting anywhere.
And I think that's the point, Mike. This is a national problem. This isn't a Charlotte problem. And I think sometimes we try to find simple solutions to very complex social problems. Our problems with education don't begin at the schoolhouse door. Our schools, to a great degree, reflect the same problems that we're seeing in society. And I think it's folly to think that we can solve our school problems simply by looking at what happens on the other side of the school door. We need it's a very complex problem, and it's going to require a complex and multifaceted solution. Well, and I don't think enough people are saying that.
I'm curious. We've asked the school system to do a lot that has nothing to do with educating children. A lot
Absolutely.
Has been put on their plate. So is fixing this systemic racism and failing children in terms of their education, not because of what they do or don't do in the classroom, but because what their lives are like outside the classroom, is that something that schools can fix and should be expected to?
We've had a lot of talk about that. Remember, we've had, is it Project Lift, right, on the west side is an example of a program attempting to address all of those outside issues that affect what goes on inside schools. I think Glenn's absolutely right. I mean, this is such a huge, complex problem. Expecting schools to fix it alone is crazy. I think most people, policymakers, I think have begun to understand that. But you have all these issues. Look just here in Charlotte, affordable housing. Can people afford to live near their jobs? Can they get to their jobs? Do you have the transit to get them to their jobs? By the way, do you have the training for them to get to their jobs? And then those jobs, do they pay them a living wage? So all these things are interconnected. Glenn's absolutely right. You can't just expect the schools to solve this.
Just yesterday, the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance released a report that talked about racial disparities in the workforce. And it pointed out that Black workers, Latino workers, they're stuck in low-paying jobs throughout whatever industry they're in. That affects education. That affects opportunities. That affects families as well. If we're going to fix the schools, we have to fix all the underlying issues that lead to these problems.
Yeah.
And simply focusing on schools or withholding money, it might make you feel good, but it's not going to address the problems. It's going to take a multifaceted approach.
So Commissioner Mark Jarrell has said we are in crisis mode. He said, I saw firsthand Friday what happens when we undereducate, miseducate, and don't educate our children. To what was he referring, Ann?
He did not elaborate. He seemed to be referring to that first night of protests, which then degenerated into looting and, you know, all sorts of mayhem. Whether he was saying that the schools were responsible for the individuals who did it or just for the overall sense of frustration that led to sort of this explosion was not 100% clear. Again, this was not a meeting where they laid out a clear-cut practical strategy. In fact, to the extent that there was one, it was that they wanted to see more data points as a CMS strategy. We have had nationally, statewide, locally, tons of data accounting, and it hasn't moved the needle much.
And School Board Chair Elise Dashew, who was listening to the County Commission meeting because everybody's doing these things virtually now, agrees that the problem is serious, but she pointed out the board has worked with former Superintendent Clayton Wilcox on a 6-year strategic plan. We've had a lot of plans in this city. We always seem to have a plan. And I always ask the question, what happens? Do they just sit on the shelf or do we execute these plans and then change direction? Because nothing moves the needle very much. Do we need another plan?
Can you imagine how many plans and task forces are going to come out of this strife and upheaval? I mean, yesterday the governor announced a task force to deal with inequities. And you're right, Mike, we've had so many commissions and reports. And I think the thing that's striking about so many of them is as soon as they finish their report and hold the press conference and tell everybody what they're going to do, they inevitably say, and this one won't sit on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And now you're asking whether they're on the shelf. So,
A week or so ago, Donald Trump threatened to pull the Republican National Convention from Charlotte if Democratic Governor Roy Cooper could not guarantee full and unrestricted use of the Spectrum Center without face masks and without social distancing. Then a game of cat and mouse ensued between the governor and the Republican National Committee over guidelines. Then the president chimed back in, giving Cooper 1 week to decide. On Tuesday of this week, he got his answer.
We cannot guarantee them that in August they can have a full arena, but we want to continue discussions about a scaled-down convention.
So, end of discussion, full stop, right? Nope, not so fast. There's news this morning. It came down to the fact that the RNC was going to keep the business end of the convention here and then move the big night of the acceptance speech to another city that could allow them no social distancing, no face masks, and full use of an arena. I'm not sure why you bifurcate a convention, but now maybe that's not going to happen. Is that the latest news? What's the latest news? It's very confusing.
I would start with, yes, it's very confusing, and who knows at this point. I think one of the things that's definitely driving this conversation now, once the president made it clear that he wanted to go somewhere else to accept the nomination, now you get into this issue of everybody's trying to avoid breaching the contract because there are inevitable lawsuits and upfront expenses incurred, and everybody wants the other person to pay for them. And so I think that's what you're seeing right now. And so this idea of maybe having the business part of the convention, which, by the way, nobody would travel for or have an interest in Charlotte, could be a way to say, well, we're not breaking the contract. See, we're still going to stage the convention there. So I think there's a lot of legal maneuvering going on right now.
And haven't they already spent about $13 million so far?
Yeah, they've spent $14 million.
Well, the interesting part of it is I had been on a phone call with Ronna McDaniel, the head of the RNC, that week before Memorial Day weekend, and she was very conciliatory, mentioning Vi Lyles and how, you know, they were in talks and trying to figure out. And it was the president with that tweet over the Memorial Day weekend that brought it to a head with this ultimatum. So at every point that they've been trying to have some discussions, he has been jumping in there to push it, and it gives him a chance to go after a Democratic mayor, governor. Roy Cooper. And so you've seen this every step of the way. And then the Republicans scurry to try to follow him. And then their language gets a little more combative about offering an ultimatum. So you see they're behind the scenes trying to figure something out. And then when you get the protests that have come, people are seeing, well, not only will you have all of these people coming in and possibly with COVID, you know, what's that going to happen? But then, oh my gosh, you're going to have protesters and counter protesters and a huge military presence. What's that going to look like in Charlotte? Business owners and restaurants and hotels who have been looking forward to it also now are thinking, you know, what's it going to look like?
You mentioned, Eric, the contractual tap dance going back and forth between the two sides, because there is that matter of contracts, something that the president is not familiar with because he tends to break them evidently as a businessman, or has done so in the past. But City Attorney Patrick Baker is insisting that Charlotte has lived up to its end of the deal.
Certainly from the city of Charlotte's perspective, we have met all of our obligations. But ultimately, when you meet those obligations, there is the expectation that each party will continue to perform.
So is he saying that since the president is pulling the plug, or the RNC is pulling the plug, somebody on the other side is pulling the plug, that we're off the hook?
I think that's certainly what he's angling for.
Could we then turn around and sue them for breach of contract?
Of course, you can always file a lawsuit about anything. I don't think the city would sue them. I think there are some people within the city that would sigh with relief that they don't have to worry about the specter of protests, of possible health risks. That's not everybody, but I think there are some people in the city that feel that way. I just think it's very interesting, going back to Mary's point, Ronna McDaniel, Marsha Lee Kelly, who is the CEO of the Republican National Convention. Most of this was very conciliatory. Ed Driggs, Republican on city council, all of those Republicans were saying, we know this is a pandemic. This convention will have to be different. There will have to be some public health concessions. And then everything turned starting on Memorial Day, when the president started tweeting about his frustration with Governor Cooper and the idea that it wouldn't be a packed 19,000 seat arena. And since then, we've just gotten into this whirlwind that we're still in, and as you said, nobody really seems to know what's going to happen at this point.
Glenn, you wrote in Q City Metro that, quote, if Charlotte is lucky, Trump will take his convention elsewhere. Is that statement based mostly on health and security reasons or something else?
I think it goes to what Eric just said, and I don't have any proof of this, but I have to believe that there are a lot of city officials who are now second guessing that decision to bring the convention here. But one of the big points that I wanted to make in that column is that if you look at our tourism industry, if you look at our hospitality industry, who are the people who are going to be most at risk if they pack out that Spectrum arena? They are Black and brown people. They're people working in food services. They're people who are working in hotels. They're the very people we're seeing right now who are being disproportionately affected by the coronavirus. We can't allow that to happen. These also happen to be the people who tend to make the least money and not have health insurance. So I think it's very selfish in a way to want to put the most vulnerable people in our society at risk simply so you can pack out an arena for a political convention.
The president would say, I want to get the country back to work because these are the very people who need these jobs and need the income that they provide, because without the jobs, they're hourly workers and they don't get paid. So what about that aspect of it? And I have about 30 seconds.
I'm a business Go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say, you heard some of that coming from the industry this week about, hey, how am I going to tell my workers that they're not going to get these desperately needed hours in this pay? So you're going to hear that argument. You are hearing that argument as a counter.
We haven't really talked much about the reason for a lot of the unrest and the reason for the cancellation of the Republican convention, or the movement of it, and that is the coronavirus. We've just kind of touched on it. Let's get a little checkup about where we are. The number of coronavirus cases in North Carolina continues to rise. Thursday saw an increase of almost 1,200 positive cases on more than 19,000 completed tests. Mecklenburg reports 4,842 cases and 105 deaths. with more than 32,000 cases across the state and 988 deaths of people, mostly in the older age group or those with underlying medical conditions. But Mecklenburg has had triple-digit increases for 7 straight days, and this is before the protests. Why?
Part of the reason, and you've heard this from health officials, is the testing is ramped up to a great degree. But it's more than that, and health officials are acknowledging that. Look, as the stay-at-home order has been loosened, it was inevitable that you were going to have an increase in cases. But there are, as with so many things with coronavirus, there are mixed messages here, because you hear Mandy Cohen, the head of the Health and Human Services agency at the state, and Gibby Harris here in Mecklenburg County saying that things are stable, but we're concerned. We need to be vigilant, but it's not time to dial back the reopening. And then yesterday, Governor said that there's a chance that there could be a phase 2.5, as he termed it, to maybe open some other businesses earlier than the phase 3 that is expected to occur on June 26th. So we have a lot of different things at play here.
Yeah. Mike, if I can hop in there, what's really troubling is that hospitalizations are on the rise, as well as the percentage of people who are testing positive. As Eric says, yes, as you test more people, you would expect to get more.
Hospitalizations are dropping across North Carolina, but they are rising in Mecklenburg County. And I'm curious as to whether that's because we have a larger population than most other counties in the state, or is it because we aren't doing a good job of social distancing and wearing masks, etc.?
Well, and we also have outbreaks in, I think, 17 congregate living facilities for elderly people. And that is one of the places where, once it gets in, and full disclosure, my mom is living in one of these places that kept it out for 2 months, and it got in and it starts spreading. It's in so many places now. So that's one factor. But yeah, I think anybody who is out at these protests has got to be wondering if we're going to be seeing a spike in another week or two.
But the largest number of cases in Mecklenburg County, 45%, are among people 25 to 49, and the second largest number, 22%, is among those 50 to 64. So I wouldn't call this a problem with elderly people at the moment in Mecklenburg County.
A part of it is political too. Even the wearing of masks and social distancing and going out has become a little bit of a partisan thing. I mean, just my husband was wearing a mask in a Park Road shopping center and got yelled at. You know, you don't need that, you know. So are we loosening up to the point of, you know, things are happening now? And so that, I think that's a little bit of it as well.
We've also been hearing that this disease has, and it's been spoken of here today, this disease has impacted African Americans disproportionately. That may be true around the country, but in Mecklenburg County, 54% of the cases are among whites, 29% are among blacks. How do we account for that?
Yeah, I don't know. Early on, you know, African Americans accounted for, I think it was half of the cases. Yep. That has shifted as the testing has broadened. At the same time, Mike, the governor said yesterday, North Carolina, 22% of the population African American, but accounting for 34% of the cases. And Hispanics really hit hard, 10% of the population in North Carolina, 39% of the cases. And by the way, Gibby Harris has talked about Mecklenburg County. The rate among the Latino population has been really devastating. That's a part of the community that they're trying to reach with more public awareness. So it is a little bit of a conundrum, that first statistic you mentioned. But when you look at it broadly, those black and brown communities are being hit harder by this virus, no doubt.
Mike, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I think the percentage you quoted might be deaths, not infections, I think.
I'm looking. I don't have that information.
Well, some of that is, as Glenn said, the essential jobs piece too, because I do see a lot of black and brown folks in the markets everywhere doing these jobs, and that's going to, you know, put you more at risk.
And of course, unemployment is the whole employment picture is disastrous at the moment. Mecklenburg County has the highest unemployment over a decade, 74,000 people unemployed. That's 12.8%, up from 9% in March. You reported, Eric, that a city council-led small business recovery task force this week pledged to begin accepting applications for $30 million worth of federal grants by June 22nd, issuing the checks by June 30th. We've heard that song before. Can they do this? Who's eligible? How do you apply?
Yeah, so for people who are interested, they should go to the city's website. They've done a special website called Open for Business that has the details on this. Mike, as you just alluded to, we've had a lot of problems, certainly with the federal programs. And one of the things, this is federally funded but city administered, one of the priorities of this is that people who have already received federal money would be put at the back of the line for this. So they're trying to hit those businesses that have been shut out. To just continue the theme of this entire show, guess what? Minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, they tend to be the ones who have not gotten much help in these initial programs. That's something that the city and, to a smaller degree, the county are trying to address with their own programs.
The county met this week and passed their budget. County Manager Dina DiOrio has said she has a feeling we're going to have some revenue troubles over the course of the year, while Elaine Powell, who's the vice chair of the commission, was even more pessimistic. She said, I believe we're heading into some very dark times. I'm concerned. But they're not raising taxes. They're not raising property taxes. They are dipping into their rainy day fund for this. Are there any major cuts?
I have not gone as deep into this as I would if I were regularly covering the county. They're saying there's not anything major. They, in fact, the employees are getting raises. They're not getting cuts. They're not across-the-board layoffs. There are some individual programs, and, of course, if you are affected by or employed by those programs, it's a very big deal.
And they're still the CMS will receive $530 million from the county, but they have still decided to withhold $11 million until CMS provides $15 an hour minimum wages for employees. Elise Dashew, the school board chair, says that might result in job cuts. So in 15 seconds, Han, how many and in what areas?
They don't know that yet. They're saying the equivalent of 175 positions, that will not mean 175 layoffs. And they kind of have a tradition of inflating, but she's saying this will be real people losing real jobs.
Ann Doss Helms is our education reporter here at WFAE News. Glenn Berkins joined us from QCityMetro.com. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV. And Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the extra time. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.